Welcome to Energy Unplugged, the leading podcast addressing the global energy transition. I'm Hugo Batten, MD of Aurora across APAC. We're delighted to be joined by today's guest, Declan Flanagan, CEO of Blue Star Energy Capital. Blue Star is a new global renewable energy investment platform focused on wind, solar, and storage. Declan's had a long and distinguished career in energy and renewable development, in particular, CEO of Airtricity, and then Eon Climate and Renewables in the early 2000s, CEO of Lincoln Energy, and then EVP of Onshore at Ørsted, amongst many other roles. This conversation will focus largely on renewable and storage development in the Australian and US markets. Declan, welcome to Energy Unplugged. Absolutely delighted you can join us.
Thanks very much, Hugo. Happy to be with you.
We're also joined today by Kimberly Liu, Aurora's research lead for US West. Welcome, Kim.
Hey there.
Terrific. So Declan, if we could start on Blue Star itself, my understanding of the logic is that, you know, while there's a lot of green capital chasing renewable opportunities, there's a shortage of deeply skilled, experienced, patient renewable development teams to bring the right wind, solar, and storage projects to market. That's probably a gross simplification, but could you just talk us through the role you see Blue Star playing in the ecosystem?
Well, before I jump into that, Hugo, just one small correction on your kind intro. I was actually CEO of Airtricity North America. The one-of-a-kind Eddie O'Connor was the CEO of Airtricity, and Eddie sadly passed away last month. And it was through meeting Eddie 25 years ago that I entered the wind power business. So I don't think I'd be chatting to you on this podcast today if not for Eddie. So I just wanted to mention that.
No, I read the obituaries. He sounded like an extraordinary character.
So, look, your summary of Blue Star, very accurate summary of the, sort of the founding conviction of the business. And I'd refine it a little, you know, based on now coming up on 2 years into it, that it's very much a middle market strategy. There's always a need for true middle market developers. Now, middle market as a term means different things, different contexts. But I think of it in terms of developers, it varies by market, who are consistently bringing one, two, three projects to NTP year on year. They're really good at managing projects from mid-stage through to NTP. My view back in 2022 was that lots of markets were well served by small, early stage developers. There's various, you know, names they have in different markets, you know, two guys in a truck, mom and pop shops, whatever. I think that sounds slightly pejorative. I think there's a huge and important role for small, locally clued in developers who specialize in bringing projects kind of to the mid stage. Okay. So the markets tend to be well served by entrepreneurial early stage developers and then also by the large balance sheet players, be they public companies, financial sponsors, what have you. Think of the multi-billion dollar balance sheet players. But a common theme was an underserved part in the middle for a few different reasons in different markets. And I would say 2 years in, I'm even firmer on that conviction. If we zero in on our business in the US, Nova Clean Energy, we've grown that to a pipeline of 5 gigawatts of wind, solar, and storage across multiple power markets. About 50% of that has come from acquisitions from the very small developers who had done great work, but had bought projects as far as they could do or often wanted to. There were not projects ready for discussions with the large multi-billion balance sheet players. And I'd say without middle market players like Nova, these projects would be stuck. They either lack capital or lack relationships with the OEMs, lack understanding of the complexities of structuring power, long-term power contracts. In the US, understanding of the fast evolving tax equity market, what have you. And what we have a formula that we've now repeated in multiple transactions, where we align interests between the seller and us as the buyer. It makes sense for us. I think in all cases, it's still a very, very good deal for the seller. So that's a model that we've seen work in Australia as well. And so that conviction of the middle market conviction of the formation of the company remains very firm. And what it's not, we're not looking to build multi-billion dollar balance sheet asset owners in any market we're in. We're not looking to build Nova Clean Energy towards an IPO. Others are, particularly in the US market, and I applaud them for doing so. I wish them success. They'll become customers of Nova as they transition to the growth requirements of existing in the public markets. But ours is very proudly a middle market strategy wherever we're doing business around the world.
No, it makes complete sense. And you've touched on it there a little bit in your answer, but it does seem like you've placed a real emphasis on a regional-based approach and region expertise. And John Fedderson, our CEO, talks about this all the time, but electricity markets and grids often are inherently local. You need teams to understand local supply chains and grids and the granular opportunities in the market. So that region-based approach makes sense to me. Is it also a bit of a reaction of some of the bigger guys you've been talking about there, where they have created global approaches, which in theory kind of helps with efficiency, but can create challenges when trying to execute on the ground, whether that's specific procurement rules or whatever it might be? Could you talk a little bit about the regional approach and I suppose how it came about?
So it's actually not a reaction to something that we perceive the big guys have done wrong. It's really about two main things. The first is aligning the interests of management in the regional platforms, management incentive schemes. I've seen so many instances where global incentive plans feel that one geography feels they're subsidizing the others, or one geography is perceived to be dragging everyone else down.
And that even happens at Aurora sometimes. John Fedderson will be chuckling as you say this.
It's a common malady in all types of businesses. So we're trying to eliminate that. This is a hard business, and we want to eliminate, you know, any sort of distractions that are taking up any unnecessary energy. And that's one I've seen time and time again. So we feel we've eliminated that by the separate businesses and separate incentive plans. The second is a pretty firm view that the world is not looking for a new global IPP. I think there's a lot of appetite for large IPPs, public markets, are US focused and European focused, but a global IPP, I'm not so sure. And that would then translate as we bring in more capital, as we grow our platforms. And I've seen this as an investor as well as someone raising capital, where we see a business that we like what they're doing in one market, but not in another market. Some investors want exposure only to the US. I think that's increasingly common. Obviously, you've got a very sophisticated investor universe in Australia. By setting up individual businesses in each market, we can bring capital directly where it wants to invest and not have a situation where you're dealing again with any noise where an investor really likes 80% of the strategy, but really doesn't, you know, is nervous about 20% of the strategy for whatever reason. So those are the two big rationales, I guess. Incentive for the people on the ground driving the business and ease of raising capital. Actually, procurement, as you mentioned it, is one area where BEC, the Topco, the holding company, I feel have actually been a big assistance to our platform companies. Myself and Neil O'Donovan, my partner, president and CEO and long-term business partner of mine, you know, we've got decade-long relationships with all the OEMs that we can provide that benefit of those relationships to our regional platforms. So procurement as well as legal HR support functions at Blue Star Topco is something I think has worked quite well in the operating model. But it wasn't a reaction to seeing those things done poorly, which I've certainly seen. That wasn't the sort of genesis of the structure.
And then maybe a final question on Blue Star before we get into broader questions about the energy transition. As you're building your regional teams, and I think you've built a crack team in Australia, you know, Aurora's worked with a lot of them for a number of years and they're a great group of people. What are the capabilities you're looking for? Like, how do you, prioritize the skill sets and capabilities of the teams you've built in each of the regions?
Look, I would say we could spend the rest of the conversation on this point. And look, we all know in any kind of business, getting the right people in the right seats and getting them all communicating in the right way is the hardest part. Look, so the most important thing is the culture fit. We try and spend a lot of time, you know, particularly in a new market like Australia, just, you know, getting to know people, getting to know the market, getting to understand the culture fit as applies in Australia. It's slightly different because the market is different and the culture is different than in the US, etc. So trying to understand, as I always say, here in Australia, I spend a lot of time, hopefully now getting to the point that I know what I don't know about Australia and getting to understand how business gets done there. And then that helps get the right fit. I'm delighted with who we've been able to get on board in Australia. Steve Jackson in Sydney, that was, you know, was clear to me from very early on, was just the right type of culture fit for us, as an example. A few things I'd zero in on, you know, on culture of the business. Someone who likes slides more than spreadsheets is unlikely to enjoy working here. We're more about numbers than stories. Someone who likes ribbon cuttings more than closing calls is unlikely to like working here. We're about execution rather than the sort of PR that comes later in execution. It's a very execution-focused culture, attention to detail, but be comfortable asking for help. This is such a fast-evolving industry. No one has it all figured out. You know, 20 years experience is often a disadvantage, I say, because, you know, you got a lot of preconceived ideas that are out of date. So it's all of those things, Hugo, you know, and look, they also evolve as we learn and the market changes. But it's just a big focus on having the right culture.
So moving into the energy transition, you know, the past couple of years have been pretty tumultuous. Particularly regarding, you know, we've seen rising financing costs and supply chain issues that have naturally driven up the cost for renewables and storage. Have these events impacted Blue Star's strategy at all?
Yes and no. I'd say yes. Obviously, it's a very different environment that all of us have been in this, you know, line of work for a lot of years. The last 2-3 years have been quite different. That has changed how one thinks about timing of signing PPAs, for example, timing and long lead time equipment, you know, vendor diligence, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I would say, fortunately, quarter two of 2022 is a pretty good time to be launching a new business, not a good time to be in the middle of trying to finance a project that was schedule dependent on hitting FID and had a PPA signed 4 years previously, et cetera, et cetera. That remains the case. If we zero in on the U.S. and the Inflation Reduction Act is still, the exact implementation of that is still being refined in terms of the financial structures around production tax credit transfer, et cetera, et cetera. And I always say that, you know, in any element of this business, you don't want to buy machine with serial number one. You don't want to do financial structure, you know, serial number one. We're very happy to be, you know, serial number 50 or whatever it might be. So we've been able to stand up the business, you know, in a time when all of these issues were very live. It's been much more painful, obviously, for those companies that made financial decisions in a time of free money and then go to execute them in a time of expensive money.
Yeah, and somewhat related to that, I think I've heard you describe these last 18 to 24 months as a necessary correction after some frothy enthusiasm. So how would you say that rising CapEx and cost of capital have impacted these PPA discussions and valuations?
First thing I'd say is, again, on higher interest rates, which I think overall, viewed over the next 20 years, the energy transition are a good thing. And why do I say that? It's often said that, you know, capital is the fuel of renewable energy plants. And so when the cost of capital goes up, it's really difficult for the renewable energy plants. I'd turn that a different way. When the fuel is free, it's used wastefully. And that was the case in the last 5, years, and certainly peak sort of wastefulness, probably, you know, 2021, 2022 timeframe. And that ultimately is not good for the energy transition. Poorly conceived projects or business plans, poorly executed, is not good for the energy transition. It's better have some failure, painful as all as it is, than to have a situation which unfortunately has stalked the energy transition and renewables over the last 20 years, that it doesn't execute at scale. And so cheap capital, too cheap a capital, was dangerous for the energy transition. The reset was a good thing. And I think it'll be viewed as a good thing looking back 10 years' time. Specifically on PPA prices, for reasons of cheap capital, ill discipline on the side of, you know, OEMs, you know, ill discipline on asset owners. I've said this many times, we were giving away our product far too cheaply. The megawatt hours were being sold far too cheaply, and often at terms that put way too much risk on the project versus the consumer of the power. That has reset massively over the last number of years, and that's only a good thing for the energy transition. The it's still a very fairly priced product relative to the alternatives. It was just crazily mispriced 5 years ago. And so I think what we're seeing now, it's not like, oh, well, PPA prices are so high. It's not. PPA prices are now rational versus irrationally low. And that was an important reset. Have you seen some slowdown in PPA signing in various markets? Of course, there's always a sticker price shock with that adjustment, but not that big of a slowdown. It hasn't halted. You see all that prices have reset, and I think people have accepted, particularly corporate customers, but I think all customers, particularly in markets like the US, Australia, where you just get huge demand growth, which obviously helps the reset. So that was just a healthy thing. And it continues to be a time when there is more discipline and also more leverage on the side of asset owners. If you've got a well-positioned project with a workable schedule and all its equipment lined up, you can get a fair price for your power right now. And I hope that remains the case, and ill discipline doesn't sneak back into the system.
Declan, maybe just to follow up on the cost one there. I mean, all of the different renewable supply chains have their own challenges, but it does seem has been a particularly tough time for wind OEMs. How do we kind of build a more sustainable supply chain? Like, what do those guys need to do differently than, I suppose, what they've been doing for the last 5 or 10 years, where the size of turbines has increased enormously, but it doesn't feel like, you know, those guys are in a particularly sustainable place at a corporate level?
A lot of what has needed to happen is happening with, you know, the big three, you know, Western OEMs. Simpler product lines, less products, more focus on managing their supply chain. The, you know, just overall more discipline. It's crucial to have a healthy supply chain and OEMs making reasonable margins, and so that they can continue to grow and innovate. While it needs to be lesser product lines, there still is a huge amount of innovation going within all those product lines. That's only going to be driven by profitable businesses. I think sort of zooming out from sort of the big three Western ones, I think the energy transition is going to need the Chinese wind OEMs to play a significant role. So we broadly, asset owners, policymakers, governments, you're going to need to think about what are the rules of the game that are going to be necessary to make that happen, because there just isn't enough capacity of non-Chinese oil. And you know, three big guys and a small, you know, it's not just a small guys in the West, is just not going to be enough supply of wind OEM. So there is an important role for the Chinese. I think this is particularly the case in Australia. I think there's a very valuable role for them to play in Australia. And I think that's going to be a key element of wind on a global basis continuing to play the big role it needs to play in the energy transition.
We're talking a little bit high level about the energy transition. Let's dive into the US and then Australia. Kim, do you maybe want to take it away on the US?
Yeah. Kind of going back to the regional approach, can you talk listeners through which regions you're focused on and what was the triage process to kind of narrow that down?
So if I think, you know, globally, you know, first we're not emerging markets investors, just don't have the experience set that for that. So that's, you know, North America, Europe, Australia sort of jump out when you do that first filter. Obviously, there are other non-emerging markets are not on that list, but that's a lot of geography I just outlined there. The US is our home market. It has been, you know, home for me for the last 20 odd years. That's my last two businesses, Connect Electricity North America, Lincoln Clean Energy, were US mid-market developers. So that's, you know, two-thirds of what we do just for that reason alone. I would also say that the US, despite its myriad of challenges, remains the most attractive power market for the energy transition, and by some distance. And so the US was always going to be, there was never any question that would be the lion's share of our capital and focus. Australia was an easy next on the list. The size of the market is attractive given the size of the power markets, you know, which I think is bigger than, you know, people might think just based on population. I like the design of the market, energy only market, very similar to ERCOT, where, you know, I've done most of my work in the last 20 odd years. Culturally similar, and again in globalizing, again second time I've mentioned that. These things are hugely important. I would say that some of the noted poor experiences in global expansion of international energy companies in the last 5 years have at their root a cultural misunderstanding of the markets they were moving into. And so Australia, we could get to the point of knowing what we didn't know somewhat quicker. And I think that's proven out. In continental Europe, it's taken us a bit longer to zero in for all the usual reasons. It's more complex, more fractured than the US, whether that's culturally, regulatory, policy, power markets, etc. But we're now pretty advanced on German battery storage and pretty excited about German battery storage because it's clear in that market and that it fits quite well in our overall portfolio approach. We have some other small investments in the value chain, so it's vast majority development platform related, but some supply chain things that we see are interesting. But I'd put that as the opportunistic tail of the strategy. It's development platforms, US, Australia, continental Europe.
And this is going to be a bit of a selfish question, given that I cover the Western interconnection for Aurora. But could we do a deep dive into the WEC for a bit and perhaps talk through the structural opportunity in that region?
Look, I think there's one thing that I think is going to be very interesting dynamic in WEC, and that is going to be the demand driven by all things AI. And that is a theme on a number of projects, both solar and wind, that's really driving, you know, and some recent acquisitions we have done that in significant part were due to our conviction on customer demand driven by our research on, you know, data center load, or, you know, just broad, you know, AI. You know, the energy consumption is just extraordinary in this space. You know, these NVIDIA chips, each one is 700 watts. You know, that, you know, so, and you see the orders in hundreds of thousands being made in batches of hundreds of thousands of these. It's going to be a pretty transformative, and, you know, a lot of WEC seems to be, you know, ideal sort of high desert type environment for a lot of that type of application. We also, one part of our strategy, again, being proudly middle market, not looking at an IPO. We're not just focused on where we can do PPAs, build, own, operate, and, you know, utility bill transfer, we're very happy to do and working on a number right now. And across WEC, we see that relative to other markets, obviously, that's not something that'll play a role in ERCOT, which is a big market for us. But we see in WEC that will be significant. and something that we would be more than happy to deliver projects by a bill transfer. And then finally on battery storage, we see it's really going to be, you know, bigger and bigger in all markets, but there's some pockets of WEC that we are particularly interested in. So it's pretty broad based. It's different to what we might do in other parts of the market, where, you know, uncontracted storage in ERCOT, for example, you know, I think the economics are, surprisingly robust, you know, based on, you know, compared to my views of as recently as, say, 18 months ago. That's not going to be something in WEC. It's more contracted, long-term contracts, utility bill transfer, but it's a very important part of our geographic focus.
Maybe pivoting to Australia then in the time we have left. And, you know, Australia, as you said before, big structural opportunity, demand growth, need to close their coal fleet over the next 10, 15 years. I think, you know, one of the many unique things about Australia is, you know, the sparsity of population over a massive landmass and therefore the fragility of the grid. And so, you know, grid modeling at Aurora was kind of founded in Australia because it's so pertinent there. I suppose, how are you guys thinking about grid risk in Australia? And, you know, there's clearly a structural opportunity. Could you talk a little bit about that as well? And I suppose how you make the trade-offs there?
An obvious fact, Australia is, you know, a very large place with, you know, same size as the continental US pretty much, but, you know, one-tenth of the people, okay? That being said, this long stringy grid point, which is mentioned a lot, you know, I haven't done the precise math, but it is a pretty concentrated population along the, you know, along the coasts and between, you know, Victoria and New South Wales and arc from Melbourne up to Sydney. I would imagine accounts for, I'm going to hazard a guess, you know, half of that population. So I have a feeling that it's in part the complexity of the grid in Australia, I think, is something that needs to be, of the grid process broadly defined, a little bit sort of challenged and scrutinized, you know, that it is, you know, one of the markets where my sense, and we would quickly run out of, I'd get out of my depth technically here, Hugo, but my sense is all of the rules are, and the standards are set that little bit higher in Australia and put that little bit more onus on the equipment OEM, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure there are some good reasons for that, but I am certain, an experience in every market I've ever been in, that these can be relaxed a little bit if they're scrutinized one by one. I think Australia should, you know, broadly, really think of doing that, because the other thing Australia has, that's the grid itself. And it's got an energy-only market. It's got one of the most volatile energy-only markets in the world. Okay. And it has got, in Victoria, New South Wales, relatively complex permitting and entitlement work. Now, those three together, you know, make for some challenges. And I think if I'm a policymaker in Australia, I want to look at the other big energy-only volatile market is ERCOT. But they make connection very easy and permitting is very easy. And so their volatile energy-only market has been absolutely no impediment to an inflow of investment. People have worried about the missing money problem, as I'm sure you guys have studied in many different ways for years. It's never been an impediment to capital flowing and investing in, whether it's merchant storage all the way back 20 plus years ago, merchant combined cycles, and right now merchant storage. Australia, there's a slight worry that the complexity of the grid combined with the complexity of the permitting timelines will slow down the movement of capital. Meanwhile, the retirement dates are staring in the face. Meanwhile, things like offshore wind are not going to be the solutions, other than in very specific areas like offshore Victoria and nowhere else. And so I think as a policy matter, Australia should make the grid, look to see if the grid access can be made somewhat simpler, have as wide a variety of OEMs on the wind side as possible, because there is a risk of there being, you know, too few suppliers for wind in Australia. So I guess I don't quite buy, oh, it must be like this, is idiosyncratic to Australia. I think it could be made easier.
It's a really good point. I mean, you can't make everything hard for developers, right? Like you need to make a couple of pieces easy. And it is interesting, the debate around wholesale-only markets as well. The Aussies have brought in what they're calling the capacity investment scheme to de-risk some new projects and stepping away from that very volatile wholesale market. And, you know, sometimes the criticism I make is that politicians enjoy making big bang announcements around new auctions, but they don't enjoy doing the detailed grid connection and planning reform that is actually often the bottleneck. But I think the Aussies are getting on top of that as well. So yeah, there's certainly different pieces here. It's certainly not just about the grid, as you say.
I totally agree with this point, by the way, Hugo, that, you know, sensible incrementalism is one of the most important things in the energy transition. And not just governments, but in the time of, you know, free money, it was all about press releases and the narrative, you know, not a cash on cash return.
Yeah.
And in a political environment, it similarly was about just press releases and the narrative, not assets in the ground. And it needs to be more focused on sensible incrementalism. How do we get from, whether we're at 20%, how do we get to 30 and 40%? We spend too much time on the big announcements and way too much time on that final 10%. Hydrogen, et cetera, yeah. When, you know, you see some of the numbers of even the very big guys of how many megawatts they have actually commissioned in a given year relative to their plans. And the energy, you know, we have not been doing a good enough job in the energy transition the last couple of years. We all need to focus more on projects getting built today and tomorrow and less on the announcements of how great it's going to look in 5 years' time.
Totally agreed. And it actually came up on the last podcast we did. But, you know, people talk about the energy trilemma, right? Decarb, reliability, cost. I think the fourth kind of underpinning is stability and coherence. You can't just be relentlessly changing the rules of the game on market participants, even if you are optimizing the top three, because that will choke off investment faster than anything else. And I think, you know, Australia, but globally, we've potentially been guilty of that over the last 5-10 years. Awesome. Maybe let's wrap up with a couple of rapid fires then, and we try and finish all podcasts on this topic. What's one out of consensus view or hypothesis that you have on the energy transition that you think is at odds with kind of conventional wisdom?
I don't know if this is out of consensus, but I would say that we do a really poor job of communicating our message to the average, you know, person in the streets. Okay. I think the energy industry, the renewable energy industry, spends way too much time sort of speaking to its friends and not enough time thinking, how will it get on board the people who are default position is anti-renewable for identity reasons, political reasons, etc. Very much a situation in the US, but I think very much a situation in Australia as well and other places around the world. And we just have done a poor job. There's too much over attribution that everything is caused by climate change, you know, when, you know, it's just not. And even if it were, maybe it doesn't help us to claim every bad thing in the world is caused by climate change. I would say my opinion is way too much over our attribution. And so the message is too elitist and smug and alarmist and shrill. And that turns people off, you know, the key I've read over the last 6 months, we would assume, oh, when people start seeing the impacts of climate change, they will come over to our side. Unfortunately, evidence in the US, in the counties that have been most exposed to extreme weather events, have become bigger Trump supporters in the aftermath of that. So actually, exposure to extreme events breeds populism. It doesn't necessarily go the other way. And so whether we like it or not, you can't alienate half the population from the energy transition or whatever the percentage might be. And our storytelling, our narrative, communication as an industry is really poor.
Just to build on that, and these were supposed to be rapid fire, but clearly I'm failing at that. What do you make of the argument? Because this is one I've made in Australia that I think we were too simplistic in the way we told the story of the cost of the transition. The argument was the LCOE of renewables were coming down, electricity would be free, everything would be awesome. And I think that led to some of the PPA, you know, declines that weren't sustainable that you saw. And actually, it was always a more complicated story, right? Like, how do you build the transmission? How do you firm this stuff? Wholesale costs might be lower, but there'll be other parts of the bills that are more expensive. Do you think that's a fair criticism of the comms around the energy transition, or is that just too subtle a debate to ever have with the general public?
No, look, I think that's a subset of the problem. I think, you know, I put it a slightly different way, Hugo. Electricity is, you know, complex, and it's not really readily, you know, sort of distilled down into sort of, you know, useful sound bites. And so the renewable energy industry just all the time waved the flag. Look how cheap we've got. Look how cheap we've got. I mean, you know, the one I always focus on is some solar project in the Gulf selling its power at, you know, $12 a megawatt hour. And it was like, this was supposed to be something to celebrate. I mean, this is the craziest thing I've ever heard, you know, giving away a product, you know, that's worth multiples of that, you know? So I think that was part of that somewhat low confidence of the renewable energy industry, that it kept thinking they might need to show it can get cheaper and cheaper and cheaper rather than focus on the value of the product. So I think that's one sort of subset of the overall problem. I think it's kind of multifaceted. I'm starting to see some of the CEOs of some of the big energy companies who have more responsibility to be the spokespeople on this. I'm starting to see that acknowledgement, but we have a lot of work to do to improve the narrative around the energy transition.
Definitely. And final question before we wrap up, and this is one that we like to ask of all our guests, who do you read or listen to in the energy space that you think is always good or especially thought-provoking?
I would have to admit that when I'm not working, I quite happily read, you know, anything but energy stuff. And I'm more likely to be listening to a history podcast, reading a history book than listening to energy. But I do. There's two books. One is energy and one is not, but both, I think, useful energy. One, which I'm sure many listeners have read, the Daniel Yergin Prize, The History of the Oil Industry. It's just a fantastic book.
Brilliant.
It has lots of little, more than little elements of that relevant to the energy transition. The other one about climate change, I don't know if it's supposed to be overtly about climate change. It's a fantastic work of science fiction. It's by a Chinese author whose name I'm not remembering right now. The Three-Body Problem. It's a big one, and I highly recommend it. I'd leave people to grab it and figure out what it's about. But it's an interesting study of a society contemplating impending disaster. And I think a lot of it reminds me of how not to and how ultimately to address climate change.
Super interesting. I found the Three-Body Problem quite hard work, but I loved the prize, though. And the new map, his new one, which is more about clean energy, is very good as well. Declan, that's been amazing. Thank you so much for your time. We've covered a huge amount there, I think in 40 or 45 minutes. We're very appreciative. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, and speak soon.
Enjoyed it. Thanks, guys.
That was Declan Flanagan, CEO of Blue Star Energy Capital, talking to Hugo Batten, Aurora's Managing Director across APAC, and Kimberly Liu, Aurora's Research Lead for US West. Do keep an eye on our podcast feed for more in-depth conversations with senior members of the energy industry. The best way to do this is to subscribe on whatever platform you use. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.